This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we will talk with the maestro, Tim Muffett. He's warming up in the bullpen for today's show and for tonight's performance as the Baton Rouge Symphony begins its season, and Tim Muffett starts year number 16, the longest-serving conductor in the history of the BRSO. And tonight's special guest is the Russian-American violinist Yevgeny Kutik. He will be with Tim Muffett in a few minutes and with us. Also, Mike Wolf, the noted attorney, longtime libertarian, and for many years an advocate for legalized marijuana. The other night in a debate, Congressman Bill Cassidy, card-carrying conservative, favored medicinal marijuana use, while Mary Landrieu and Rob Manis said, no way, we'll talk about it. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. We lead off our show today with the maestro Tim Muffett, who has a very special guest in studio that will be a very special guest tonight on stage, 7:30 at the River Center as the symphony opens its season. And Tim Muffett, the longest-serving conductor in the history of the Baton Rouge Symphony, begins year number 16. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Jim. It's great to be here.
Good to see you as always, and you're smiling. I know you're very enthused about what's going to happen tonight and the rest of the season.
Yes, can't wait to get started. It's been a fun week in rehearsals, and I think we have a very, very special evening to share with the audience tonight.
This young man who is in studio with us today is only 29 years old, but he's been around for over a decade. Yevgeny Kutik is a Russian-American concert violinist. His career debuted in 2003. With an appearance with the Boston Pops. Good morning, Yevgeny.
Morning, how are you doing?
And you've come to Baton Rouge. You've been here a few days. What do you think so far?
I like it. It's beautiful. Great weather. Nice views.
Where do you live most of the time now?
I'm based in Boston.
Based in Boston. So you've been away from Russia for a while.
A long time. I moved when I was five.
Well, Boston's a good place to be for what you do. And tonight you'll be doing it on stage. And Tim, I know you are elated that Yevgeny is with us because you know the backstory about the latest CD.
Yes, I'm elated first and foremost because he's an extraordinary violinist. I really feel one of the most distinguished of his generation, as our audience will hear tonight. But along with that, he does have a very compelling story to tell that involves his most recent compact disc, which was reviewed by the New York Times very favorably, among other publications. But when you get a great New York Times review, that says a lot and tells us quite a bit about him as an artist as well.
What was the inspiration for the latest work?
My family and I, we moved to this country when I was five. It was a 6-month journey, actually. I was 4 and a half when it started. And essentially, my parents decided to abandon, to escape, I guess, so the Soviet Union, because they were so fed up with the rampant anti-Semitism at the time. And so to do that, you essentially became a refugee, had refugee status, and you were, you know, you had your status taken away, you had your passport taken away, and you couldn't really take your belongings, you couldn't take money. So long story short, we left and we had to stuff everything into just several suitcases for six of us. And my mom, who's a violinist, decided that with these prized possessions that we'll be stuffing into these suitcases, one of those possessions will be a collection of old music scores. And so she put them in there, and we arrived in the United States, and I grew up, you know, basically an American kid. And later in life, as my career sort of started going and I knew this is what I was going to be doing, I started to actually get quite curious about these scores that mm-hmm. were sitting on the shelf in our music room. And I started opening them up, and I found incredible compositions by Russian composers, by non-Russian composers, but beautiful works that many of which I did not know at that point. And I decided with what these scores represent, and just the whole story, I thought I would make a CD out of it.
And here it is.
Yeah.
And the title is appropriately?
Music from the Suitcase.
Very good. So you came to the U.S., what, in 89 or 90, somewhere around there?
We came in 19, yeah, that's right, in 89.
89. And where did you originally locate?
Pittsfield, Massachusetts, in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts.
So you've become acquainted with the Eastern Seaboard.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up.
When did you start playing the violin?
Right at like five, I think. Yeah.
After you came to the United States.
Yeah.
Well, it's an amazing story, and this guy has some staying power. I'm sure he'll be playing a long time after we're no longer around, Tim, but but he already has a rich body of work.
Yes, and I had the privilege of doing a concert with him just a few weeks ago, and I'm very excited about this performance.
Where was the concert a few weeks ago?
It was in Lansing, Michigan, with the Lansing Symphony. And very excited to have him here in Baton Rouge. I know our audience is going to have a great time.
And I'm sure the response in Michigan was astounding.
Very strong, yes.
Okay.
Also tonight, we're going to be announcing this year's Pennington Great Performers Concert. So that might be incentive to be there, and tickets will go on sale.
Another reason, yes.
Yes, absolutely.
Outstanding. Well, Frank Barnett, our producer, I think has a sampling of Evgeny Kutek, who is one of the most prominent violinists in the world, and he's only 29 years old, a Russian-American who came to this country before he was 5 years old and has made quite a mark. Quite impressive from Evgeny Kutek, who has been hailed by the New York Times and other publications for his fantastic work at such a youthful age. And Tim Muffet tonight, he's a good opening act for the season.
It's going to be great, yes. We do try to set the bar very, very high.
And you've done that again. And Evgeny, who grew up in the Massachusetts area by way of Russia, do you remember much about the country where you were born?
Very vague. I remember images of some stuff, like the house and stuff, but not much.
Well, Russia has produced some very good musicians.
Yes, it has. Yes. Performers and violin, the violin tradition of Russia and then later the Soviet Union is extraordinary, and we're going to hear part of that lineage.
What sets apart a guy like Evgeny from others?
That's a great question. There are literally hundreds of very fine violinists out there who can play all the notes and play them in tune and play with a beautiful sound. And then there are a handful that add something that's almost indescribable. And that's in the style, that's in the nuance, in the expression. Someone who takes the printed page and elevates it beyond what others can do. And I feel that's where Evgeny is really special.
As a young man in America, did you listen and appreciate other kinds of music?
Sure. I mean, you know, I grew up quite normally. I went to school and all I listened to whatever my friends were listening to at the time. And I mean, yeah, I love all sorts of music, I mean, especially jazz, but I certainly don't.
Well, Tim has acknowledged that he's a fan of the Beatles.
The Beatles, of course, yeah.
Who isn't?
By the way, I saw Paul McCartney last Saturday.
How was that?
He went for 3 hours.
That's what I hear.
At the age of 72.
Yeah, I understand. I understand that the band took breaks, but he didn't.
He just kept on going.
Yeah, that's really remarkable.
It is remarkable, but that kind of love of what he does, right. And in his case, he doesn't have to do it, but right. it's what he does.
Right. And he is an extraordinary musician. And you know, Duke Ellington had a great comment. He said, there's only two kinds of music, good music and the other kind. And I think that, you know, Paul McCartney is one of the 20th and now 21st century's great musicians. And, you know, the style of music is not important, but he does what he does mm-hmm. really well.
Well, he changed guitars for everything he did. He did not play the same guitar twice in a row. Throughout a concert, which had 40 selections.
Oh, my
40.
Gosh.
Wow. And he also played the piano. So do you change the violin through it?
No. I guess I'm not quite like Paul yet. Yeah.
Not yet.
Not yet.
But he's a handsome young man, and of course, stage presence is a big part of what you do.
It is a big part of it. That's why people come to a live concert. I mean, you know, anybody can throw a CD in, and but the live performance is where you get that extra, energy. The audience is part of the experience. You get to see what's going on and have the full experience. There's nothing. Live music is best.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I noticed about Paul McCartney, he's lean. He's leaner than he's ever been, and you have to be in shape.
Yeah, I mean, it's grueling. The schedule, always on a plane somewhere, waking up God knows where, and having to go out and perform your best, and the audience doesn't really care where you were yesterday. They want you to be, you know, in top shape. So it's all encompassing. You have to take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure Evgeny will find out that Baton Rouge welcomes talent in an appreciable way. You'll certainly get quite a response tonight. And this month, the last few weeks have been sad ones because we lost somebody who's synonymous with classical music in this community, in Connie Navratil.
Yes, that was shocking and tragic to all of us who knew her, and it's just such a huge presence in the classical music world. We're all going to miss her terribly.
And she certainly was associated with the symphony.
Well, she was the host for our broadcasts, and I remember back in the day, she used to have me on her morning show to talk about the program that was coming up, much as you are this morning. And she just had I think she probably brought classical music to, I'm sure, hundreds of thousands of people through her work.
She did. And tomorrow, Friday, our community will herald the life of Connie Navratil. Services are at 11 a.m. at St. Luke's Episcopal. So for those who remember Connie, either personally or as a media personality, this is an opportunity to say farewell to one of the grand dames of this community and a big part of WRKF since its inception. January 18th, 1980, she was on the air nearly 35 years ago when the station went on the air. And Tim Muffet has started year number 16 with the Baton Rouge Symphony Orchestra. I'm sure at least another 16 years are in the tank.
I hope so. And we'll try to get Yevgeny back here for at least maybe 8 of those.
Well, another 16 years, he'll only be 45. When does a violinist hit his or her prime?
I don't know. That's tough. I don't know. I hope to always be learning and improving. I never hope to be at a point where I think I've reached it. Honestly, if I can go out and play better each day, then I'm going to be happy.
Well, I think that you have some great years remaining, and perhaps your best performances are ahead.
I hope so.
But there is a time in life when it's hard to sustain it, and that's why it's so remarkable when a 72-year-old man like Paul McCartney,
right.
He didn't even take a drink of water for
right.
3 hours.
And singing, too. You know, that's usually one of the first things to go in the human musical body is the voice.
The voice. Well, tonight, Evgeny Kutik, Tim Muffet, and the Baton Rouge Symphony Orchestra. It's, of course, the usual place, the River Center Theater, 214 St. Louis Street. You may find out more by going to BRSO or call 225-383-0500, 225-383-0500. Thank you, Tim Muffet. Thank you, Evgeny, and good luck tonight.
Thank you.
We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. You may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show and reach us via email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. The other night, the Senate hopefuls, the candidates who are allegedly still in the hunt for the runoff that will likely happen after the votes are tallied on November 4th, Rob Manus, Mary Landrieu, Bill Cassidy, they showed up in Shreveport at Centenary College on the same stage where Frank Sutton, the guy who played Sergeant Carter in Gomer Pyle, died many years ago. But nobody died the other night. But Bill Cassidy perhaps had the biggest bombshell of the night when he supported medicinal marijuana. And for many years, Mike Wolf, the most prominent libertarian in the state, local lawyer of renown, has been an advocate for marijuana legalization. And a recent decision by California voters back in, actually, I say recent, it was 1996, 18 years ago, to legalize medical marijuana produced a wave of similar initiatives around the country. And less than two decades later, over half the states allow at least limited medical use. Now it looks as though recreational use of the drug may follow the same path, and it looks to be the wave of the future. But in Louisiana, on these kinds of issues, we remain relatively conservative. And Mary Landrieu, who has been blasted as a, quote, liberal, she says no, no to medical marijuana, a Democrat, as did Rob Manus, the Tea Party candidate in the race. But Bill Cassidy, Republican, former Dukakis Democrat, he says go for it. And he's a doctor, so he does have some credibility when it comes to matters of medicine. Mike Wolf, were you stunned?
I was a little surprised, but I'd heard Representative Cassidy say things of that kind before. He mentioned at least a year ago that he was considering that supporting the legalization of marijuana for medical purposes. And it certainly does make sense. And as you say, because he comes from a medical background, he might be expected to be more alert to the issue than the others are.
And he was asked first. And yes. If he had been asked last, who knows, his answer might have been different. But I suspect on this, his medical background and what he believes is appropriate for somebody in pain, it supersedes other considerations.
Yes, it would seem so. It's definitely very uncompassionate to not allow people in great sickness and pain to not have the benefit of a mild analgesic like marijuana, which by all reports is very effective.
Well, my guess is of the three, Manus probably has not used marijuana. A military guy who I think he is the real deal. He's the most sincere of the three candidates. The other two, like it or not, they are politicians. At some point in their lives, they may have partaken. But Mary Landrieu says she has not. At least she did many years ago when Pat Simon asked her. And Bill Cassidy, I suspect if he were asked, he would say, "No, I've never used marijuana." Why is that still an issue after all these years?
Well, cognitive dissonance is one reason. When people have spent 30 or 40 years demonizing marijuana and all other illicit drugs, it's hard for them to change their minds without appearing to be foolish or wicked. And that's human nature. But there, it also reflects stubbornness. It also reflects a very antediluvian mindset that refuses to believe evidence mm-hmm. and when it's in front of one's eyes. And we see that with the continuation of this drug war. And even when, fortunately, we have some states where the people are seeing the light, and we now have virtually legal marijuana in Washington State and Colorado. And I understand there's an initiative before the Alaska voters this year to mm-hmm. possibly take the same step. They had actually taken a similar step judicially decades ago. But it's inconsistent with the Constitution. That's why it's inconsistent with any right to privacy to say that the government can determine what medication you use, and especially an herbal natural medication like cannabis, and to say that you're going to be jailed and you're going to be defined as a criminal if you use it. It's just ridiculous.
Well, there are people serving life sentences in this state for marijuana possession.
Yes.
Not distribution, possession.
Yes, because it's one of a series of offenses, and there are provisions for enhancing penalties with several offenses. And that's totally unjust. How can these people that claim that put up their hands and swear to defend the Constitution support laws like this and practices like this? To me, it's just outrageous. And it's seeping through into the general consciousness, and it's seeping into the Republican Party little by little. People like Ron Paul and now his son Rand Paul have helped present this view to the Republicans. And I think some of them are being forced by logic and objective reason to change their opinions.
Okay. Well, the New York Times reports that Colorado, January through June of this year, raised about $19 million from legalized marijuana. This could be a boon for Governor Jindal, who does not like taxes, as we know. If we had the same kind of tax on marijuana that we have on other products, the state might be able to avert cuts to higher education and health care.
Well, many people have supposed that it's only the fiscal crises that have caused this issue to start shifting, that have caused people to start accepting legalization of marijuana because of the revenue opportunities. And if as to that, I say, well, better that reason than not doing it at all. But it's time to restore a little justice to our criminal laws.
All right, 297-5633. We will go to the phones in just a moment with Mike Wolf. Did Congressman Cassidy get your vote the other night?
I thought he did well in a number of ways. In other ways, he seemed a little bit too monotonously condemning of the president. But I enjoyed the performances of each of the candidates. I thought Mary Landrieu did a good job. He was very aggressive as far as debating goes. And I was impressed with Colonel Maness. And I was impressed with Cassidy's mastery of the facts. He gave a number of rapid-fire comments that showed a great understanding of the details of a number of the issues they discussed. So I was impressed with all of them, but I'm voting for Brandon McMorris, the Libertarian, in the first round.
In the first round. But in the second round?
In the second round, I'm much more leaning to Cassidy now. I wasn't sure.
And, you know, we all have issues that are near and dear to us. We call these people one-issue voters. I don't think Mike's a one-issue voter, but this issue is certainly one that you... I think you believe it's symbolic of many other issues.
That's correct. Well, for example, the reproductive privacy. I have always favored Mary Landrieu because of her staunch support of women's reproductive freedom. Now, that is an immensely important libertarian issue. And many libertarians, even the Paul family, particularly Ron Paul, have not stood firm on libertarian principles by agreeing to prohibit abortion, which is a private decision. And so balancing the seeing the light on the drug laws against preserving reproductive freedom causes a difficult judgment there. But I think we should be looking at constitutional issues like this and the right to privacy and see which of the candidates are really defenders of the Constitution.
877-217-5757, wherever you are, for Mike Wolf. Veronica in Denham Springs. Good morning, Veronica.
Hi. Is it possible that being a former Democrat is like being born a Catholic? The remnants are never taken completely away from you, and that we would see Senator Cassidy that's more open-minded than we expect? Thanks.
Well, maybe so, but I don't think Democrats are particularly open-minded. They may be about some things, but on some things they're very close-minded. For example, balancing budgets, following the Constitution concerning the declaration of war, following the Constitution concerning personal privacy. The way opinions are formed is a very interesting subject, and it does have to do with things like the perception of a party as being tied to a cluster of issues. So in that sense, you may have a point. Some people think of certain positions on issues being identified with being Democrat, and others Republican and so forth, or Libertarian. Mm-hmm. And that maybe helped inform their opinions.
Well, when Bill Cassidy was 31, he was backing Michael Stanley Dukakis for president and writing letters condemning Ronald Reagan to the editors of newspapers. When he was 45, he was backing Mary Landrieu in her quest for a second term in the U.S. Senate against three staunch Republicans, Susie Terrell, Tony Perkins, and John Cooksey. And when he was 46, he was backing Kathleen Blanco for governor against Bobby Jindal. And then, shortly thereafter, he got the political bug and had an epiphany almost overnight and has voted the way that he has campaigned, which means he's been a staunch Republican. So I think, Cassidy, this marijuana thing may be an aberration, but I think he will be a conservative, like that or not. Some people are saying, yeah, that's great, but I don't have any doubt that he would vote extremely conservatively along with most members of his party.
Well, of course, conservatives like Barry Goldwater and William Buckley and many others have realized that privacy is a conservative value and that it is none of the state's business what someone chooses to eat, drink, or smoke. And so it's not necessarily a non-conservative position. If you're a constitutional conservative like Goldwater, you'll appreciate it mm-hmm. and realize that you should tolerate other people, live and let people make their own decisions.
But Cassidy is an expert on medicine, and he was a very good doctor, as is his wife, or was his wife. And I think in a case like that, he's dealt with people dealing with liver disease, and probably he knows that marijuana sometimes can be a stress and pain reliever when somebody is in the final stages of life.
I suspect so, and I think he's also sensitive, though, to constitutional issues. I don't mean to pretend that he's not at all sensitive to them. He draws a strong line at an abortion prohibition because of his religious beliefs, apparently, but I suspect that he believes strongly in the Fourth Amendment on other aspects of privacy. So I think he's being quite logical if that is part of his reasoning, and he understands that people should be allowed to make their own decisions. I wrote a letter to the editor of the local newspaper around the time Cassidy was first elected to the legislature, and I ran into him shortly thereafter, and he said he agreed with just everything I'd written. And I had, I think, described the libertarian point of view in general as being limited government, free markets, and personal responsibility. And he said, I agree with you. That's exactly mm-hmm. what I believe.
Well, the other night, one of our callers yesterday said Cassidy reminded this listener of Richard Milhouse Nixon, and you were a former Nixon supporter.
Yes.
That probably also endeared you to the congressman.
Well, maybe, but yes, my Republicanism was a little bit naive when I started out, and it was largely due to anti-communism and so forth. And I was very influenced by Barry Goldwater. Mm-hmm. By his writings.
Well, no Republican wants to be compared to Richard Nixon, or Democrat for that matter. Nixon, who had his charms, was a disgraced American president. And Bill Cassidy, let's face it, in 1974, when Nixon was resigning, Cassidy was not yet 17 years old, wasn't even eligible to vote. And at that time, he was a budding Democrat. And as Trey Orso, the former chair of the Democratic Party, said yesterday on this program, Cassidy came to his office in 1999, and he decided he wanted to run for something, and he was going to run as a left-leaning Democrat. And he knew a few years later that the state had moved rightward, and he moved with the state. And he's been successful. He has not lost a race. How do you view this one, Mike Wolf? Will people like you be the deciding factor in December? You'll cast your vote for somebody else, and you say now if the election were today, you'd be leaning toward Dr. Cassidy.
Yes, perhaps so. What the libertarians are always striving to do is become the balance of power right now while we're in such a minority posture. But clearly he appeals to libertarians by supporting greater personal privacy. You speak about Nixon. It's ironic. Nixon started the war on drugs. He was the one who first began that propaganda. And
he had Elvis helping him, right?
That's right.
Elvis Presley.
Right. But he also went to China and stopped the Vietnam War. And, these people aren't mixed bags. It's always wrong to think of politicians as purely good or purely bad.
It did take him some time to stop the Vietnam War. I recall in 1968 he had a secret plan that he said would take 6 months, and 6 months turned into 6 years.
Yeah, well, I think first he tried to stop it by winning, dominating them, and then realized he couldn't do that, so he did the next mm-hmm. more sensible thing to get
Henry,
out.
Henry Kissinger said that Nixon was drinking heavily in those days, and war is tough on presidents, I'm sure. And Nixon, unlike Bush and Cheney, and Clinton, he'd actually seen war. He fought and won. But today, Obama, he certainly hasn't fought in any war. Should we have a warrior in the Oval Office, Michael Wolff?
It doesn't matter. We should have patriotic people. We should have people who have thought deeply about the use of military power and when it's appropriate and when not, and who are capable of studying the issue and getting the best advice from the most expert people available. But I don't think it should be a requirement or a disqualification in anyone's mind.
And when the American people have been given an opportunity in recent times to elect war heroes like John Kerry and John McCain, they've opted to go the other way.
Right. And of course, we have a strong tradition of civilian rule in this country, and thank goodness. Military men oftentimes show a narrow mindset, and that oftentimes they're not as open-minded as people in other professions. I don't know why. I think it's because they're taught to march in lockstep and to follow authority and so forth, and so they're not very creative sometimes.
Well, one of the greatest presidents, according to Americans, now historians, many would disagree, but John Kennedy is often mentioned as the greatest American president, and he was a war hero, no doubt about that. What he did in World War II was heroic, and PT-109 is part of our culture. And the thanks he got was to be assassinated in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963. And I see that a Dallas tour company is being heavily criticized for the placement of a photo of President Kennedy on the side of one of its buses. The owner of Dallas City Tour has received so much negative feedback that he's been forced to cover up the image of the slain president. The image that got so many fired up, Mike, is a picture of JFK's head with the words, "Big things happen here."
Yes, I heard about that. It seems to be very bad taste. We were talking about scandals, political scandals, and there's a whole category of them that can be put in the category of bad taste. That's certainly a good example of bad taste in a commercial context.
Well, as mentioned, when Mary Landrieu was asked many years ago by Pat Simon whether she smoked pot ever, she said no. And I guess the question now is whether a Louisianian seeking statewide office or a U.S. Senate seat could survive an admission of smoking pot. And we'll talk about some things going on around the country, including Paul Davis, front runner a few weeks ago in the governorship race for Kansas. Now he's fighting for his political life after it was acknowledged that he made a strip club visit in 1998. His response, "I was in the wrong place at the wrong time." And in Oregon, Sylvia Hayes, who's never been a conventional first lady, has revealed that when she was 29, she was paid $5,000 to marry an 18-year-old man who wanted to stay in the U.S. in a sham marriage. And the governor is standing by her. Could something like this fly in Louisiana?
You know, we all know about people who have remained popular after criminal convictions.
Well, hold that thought. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633 for libertarian lawyer Mike Wolff, who at the time, through the years, has been on this show defending many people under fire for various transgressions, including David Letterman. I remember a few years ago, Mike was passionately supporting him, saying it was nobody's business if Letterman was sleeping with members of his staff on The Late Show. And Bill Cassidy, speaking of The Late Show, he's trying to make a runoff with Mary Landrieu and quite likely will. And the other night, he probably gained some votes and lost some votes when he announced that he, unlike his two other major candidates, is supportive of medicinal marijuana. 297-5633. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Mike Wolff.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Mr. Wolff. My question to you, as we look around, I mean, you wake up and you're in your everyday life, and things that happen to be the way they are have a history. I mean, something happened to make that situation occur. Do you know the history of what made marijuana illegal to begin with? I understand it was something to do with competing with tobacco or alcohol. that basically it was an industrial, a corporate interest that wanted to make it illegal?
Richard Bonney of the University of Virginia Law School did a history of marijuana called the Marijuana Conviction back in the 70s. And as far as I understand that his recitation is accepted generally, it was really more a matter of discrimination against ethnic minorities who had recently come to the country. For example, Mexican laborers and Chinese laborers on the West Coast. In particular, one of the states that first got took action against marijuana was Minnesota. And there were reefer madness type articles in the paper about beetfield peons going crazy on their Saturday nights smoking marijuana. And it was really just bigotry, just ignorance and bigotry toward outsiders, foreigners, that really started it. And then New Orleans had a big role in it. They got involved because of the shipping and all. People came from other places, and there was marijuana down there, particularly in the musical subcultures. And those who disliked the blacks and the other groups that were foreign to the local society connected it, joined it in their minds with their prejudice against those people and said, well, this, we can't let this this noxious substance go on. And it's basically, it was connected to use by out-groups.
297-5633 is your number. The other night at the Paul McCartney concert in New Orleans, there was evidence that pot smoking was going on in the arena.
Well, now, Paul McCartney, of course, famously got caught going into Japan with a lot of marijuana that was...
He was arrested.
Yes, yes. And I'm sure he wasn't going to sell it. He was taking it for his own use.
Mm-hmm. And it was Bob Dylan who turned him on to pot.
I've heard.
Yeah, but he's done pretty well, and at 72, I tell you what, that guy has probably a 30-inch waist. I would imagine that food consumption, in many cases, is much more dangerous than marijuana consumption.
Yeah, like Paul's an ardent vegetarian.
He was.
Oh, he's not anymore?
I don't know. I don't know. Okay. I suspect he's still true to his younger vision of life when he was with Linda, but as we found out now, eating all those carbs is sometimes is worse than eating lots of meat as far as bloating up. And he's gotten lean and mean, and at 72, whatever he's doing, I'd like to know.
I wish I'd seen the show.
Yeah, but...
he's great.
But could a candidate today, if one of the three the other night, if the follow-up question by Beth Courtney had been, have you ever used marijuana? And one of them said, yes, and I use it now. In fact, I used it 15 minutes before the debate tonight. Would they be elected in Louisiana?
It depends how brazen it is, I think, really. It reminds me of Jay Darden, who's like very much and hope to support for governor if the Libertarian doesn't win, is said once he objected to the gambling being so much in your face. And that amused me a little. It was to suggest that perhaps gambling would be okay if it wouldn't be so visible. And it's like zoning with regard to strip clubs and vice districts and so forth, advertising. The last three presidents have smoked marijuana. At least one of them lied about it, Bill Clinton.
He didn't lie. He just didn't lie about smoking it. He just said he didn't inhale.
And who believes that? That's a lie. I'm certain. I contend. I will contend.
He would never lie, would he?
I'd never lie about that. But at any
not
rate...
Not about that.
The point is lying. You talk about morality. It's fair for the public to evaluate anyone based on their truthfulness. So if a guy gets up and says, oh, I've never smoked marijuana, or look at Clarence Thomas, who was put on the Supreme Court, who I suspect that he lied about his encounters with Anita Hill. And the winners write the history, like they say, but it's fair game for people to inquire about that and see how it's discussed. But I think that if it were honestly dealt with by a candidate today, like one in a congressional race or any other important race, he said he had smoked marijuana, I don't think the voters would make that a disqualifier. If he said, oh, and I'm growing a field of it right now, they might think that was too much. But I don't think having smoked marijuana would be, because for one thing, almost anyone who's born after 1950 has tried marijuana or been around it or certainly knows someone who has.
Well, I recall a few years ago on this show, Smiley Gray Anders, who was born in 1937, he said he was growing a marijuana plant in his backyard in Spanish Town, And he said that when he got home, there was quite a crowd there. And I said, well, were the cops there? And he goes, no, the neighbors. Deborah Davitt writes, by forcing people to lie about using marijuana, are we creating a negative environment that increasingly finds unethical behavior the norm?
That's a good question, just what we're talking about. Yes, I think we're forcing people into a hypocritical position, but they're making the decision themselves. It's because they're so afraid, and that's a problem with politicians today. We say chickeny, they don't want to admit the truth of what they've done, and they're afraid someone's going to hold it against them, so they become liars and hypocrites and phonies. It would be much better if they were honest about their activities.
Well, this guy, Paul Davis, who may end up being the next governor of Kansas, is now fighting off this, what he calls a desperate smear campaign. But he has acknowledged, this is his quote, when I was 26 years old, I was taken to a club by my boss. The club owner was one of our legal clients. While we were in the building, the police showed up. I was never accused of anything, having done anything wrong, but rather I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. In a strip club. Strip clubs are legal. There's one here in Baton Rouge, a very prominent one. If, let's say, Governor Jindal was seen in the Penthouse Club, would that be a disqualifier for him to be president of the United States?
I think some people, it might make him seem more human. Maybe he'd look more positive to some people. But that's one of those matters of taste, I think, really. I've always found strip clubs to be very boring and tedious, really. They're the kind of things people can't.
So you've been there?
Of course I've been to them, but mainly I think about bachelor parties. That's where the kind of event you usually I usually hear about in them. If I want to go have a drink, I never think about going to a strip club to do it. And as far as the sex, it always struck me as ersatz and very unsatisfying. Mm-hmm.
Well, I remember when Bill Clinton was consorting with Jennifer Flowers, some people said, never trust a Jennifer whose name starts with a G. Well, this governor of Oregon, his common law wife, her name is Sylvia, and it's with a C, C-Y-L-V-I-A, Sylvia Hayes. And she has acknowledged that her third marriage to an Ethiopian immigrant was a sham marriage in 1997, in which she was paid $5,000 at the age of 29 to marry an 18-year-old man. Now, the governor, John Kitzhaber of Oregon, is standing by her, even though he is in a difficult political race, but he is a Democrat, and Democrats are popular in the blue state of Oregon. Should he ditch Sylvia with a C and move on, or should he put his heart ahead of his political endeavors?
That reminds me of Mayor de Blasio, who's getting static. He's getting complaints filed against him. People are criticizing him because his wife's chief of staff is living with a guy that's apparently an ex-con and has been criticizing the New York police. But no, come on, that's not the person. People can, we forgive sinners, don't we? People can make mistakes, and they ought to be able to walk away from it, so that we shouldn't condemn people forever for indiscretions in their past.
And when it gets down to family members, that's like the story about Landrieu's son getting a DWI and Cassidy's daughter having a child out of wedlock. What relevance does that have to do with the suitability for either one of them to be a U.S. senator?
Relatively little, but you can say if you have a more serious problem, suppose look at the judge's son here who stole from the evidence room a whole lot of cocaine and so forth. If the behavior of children is bad enough, it supports an inference that the child rearing wasn't done as well as it might have been. And so you can say that reflects on their child rearing skills and can say something about the character. But in general, I would say what you say is accurate. It should not be relevant. The foibles, the sins, the crimes of relatives shouldn't be charged against candidates.
Here's another scandal of a different kind that sacked a U.S. senator. The Army War College has rescinded the master's degree of Senator John Walsh of Montana, determining that Walsh, who's a Democrat, plagiarized his paper there, his final paper, in 2007. Walsh, who's a retired colonel in the National Guard, withdrew from this year's election in August, weeks after the New York Times reported that he had copied large portions of the paper he submitted as a requirement to graduate from the Army War College. His withdrawal basically cedes the race to a Republican, Steve Daines, a congressman. So the Democrats lost a seat over plagiarism, yet the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, has been outed as a plagiarist not once but twice and survived to fight another day.
Well, now, plagiarism is a serious offense to honesty. We always want honesty in politicians. Right now, it's gotten so people actually believe it's okay to lie to the public, that politicians have a license to lie. To me, dishonesty is an important disqualifier. And some of the more effective ads that Mary Lander has run against Cassidy have been some that suggested that he has misrepresented his positions and so forth. I'm not sure about how accurate they are, but I hear some of these fact checkers have said both candidates have inaccurate ads. But honesty is important. And so if someone has, say, smoked marijuana, gone to strip clubs, fathered children out of wedlock,
you're okay with that.
They should, but the point is they should be able to admit it. And if denying it and lying about it is an offense that may be worse than the underlying offense.
Well, Biden lied about being a plagiarist. And, of course, plagiarism by nature means that somebody is a liar. Should he not be Vice President of the United States?
Well, I sure would have never voted for him for dog catcher. Biden. No, Biden. To talk about a terrible drug warrior. Golly, but Biden is just insufferable to me.
Okay, a couple of other items locally. A listener asked about this Ebola situation. The Attorney General, Buddy Caldwell, is concerned about Ebola, so he is filed for a restraining order to keep Thomas Eric Duncan's cremated remains out of Louisiana. Chemical Waste Management, which operates a landfill where Duncan's ashes were to be laid, say there is no danger, but Caldwell says he's protecting the people of Louisiana, keeping these ashes out of the state. Is he making the right call, Mike Wolf?
Perhaps so. That's something that depends on medical expertise. Maybe we could ask Dr. Cassidy. But I trust our public health officials. That's something, an area where we have to trust experts, and not rely on just emotionalism. Mm-hmm. I don't really know whether it's a hazard or not. And I guess when you talk about nuclear waste, for example, everybody knows that's hazardous, and many states
refuse to let it be dumped. But if it's been incinerated,
garbage, sludge,
my guess is that it would not be
I would guess so,
waste.
Too, but I'd like to hear
I would
it
think
from,
it would be very difficult to get Ebola from ashes.
From ashes, yes, probably
but
so.
Buddy Caldwell is ardent in protecting the citizenry of Louisiana.
It might be more of a political statement than a realistic.
And name. Yesterday was a big day for Governor Bobby Jindal. The Louisiana Supreme Court upheld a hotly debated state law, making it more difficult for public school teachers to earn and retain tenure. The ruling for the second time reversed a decision by State District Judge Mike Caldwell, who concluded the overhaul was illegally approved by the legislature because it jammed too many subjects into a single bill. So Judge Caldwell ended up being overturned by the Supreme Court, and we've got quite a judicial race going on between Caldwell and Randy Piedrahita. Are you following that one?
Yes, I am. I read the story in the paper the other day, and I've read the flyers that have come to my home. I'm glad to see they're campaigning hard, but I've always had a good impression of Judge Caldwell, and I don't know much about Piedrahita, but he's trying to run because he's with showing pictures of himself dressed as a SWAT team officer.
Which one?
Piedrahita. He was on a SWAT team, and he's got flyers going around to the houses. Now, that's an example of kind of militaristic overreach, I think. We're militarizing our police forces too much, and for a guy to run for office and say, I'll be a good judge. Look, I'm a SWAT team guy. To me, that's not the right image for a judge. You expect a little more balance, and it suggests a prosecution bias.
Judges be tough on crime.
Tough on crime, yeah.
I do have a message here from a high-ranking official at the Department of Health who says the incinerated remains were not those of Mr. Duncan. Those remains were given to Mr. Duncan's family. And it is interesting that they're allowed to keep his remains, which I think is good. But the remains in Louisiana that Buddy Caldwell is fighting to keep out of the state are from items like bed linens.
I've read that in the newspaper, and again, it doesn't seem to be a problem, but I think the health authorities can take care of that. There ought to be a lot for the Attorney General to be doing.
Finally, Cassidy may have gotten your vote the other night if it comes to a runoff. But what is the biggest issue? Is it pot? What's the biggest issue in this race?
Well, I'd say there are two: constitutional privacy. and applying the Constitution to our criminal justice system, and then the economic ordering of the society, the fiscal and monetary policies of the federal government.
All right, always a delight to talk with you, Mike Wolf. Thanks for being so erudite as always.
Thank you, Jim.
And we shall return tomorrow with Bob Mann hosting. Until then, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.